Thank you for joining us here for another wonderful episode with Mental Health Insights. My name is Craig, and I am here with Shirley Crenshaw. Hi, Shirley.
Hi there.
So Shirley and I we've talked about this on the podcast kind of hit or miss different times, and Shirley is an expert in attachment. So today's episode, we're really going to talk about what we mean whenever we say attachment, and really the implications that it has for a lot of us whenever our attachment needs or attachment styles or like our attachment type behaviors. We want to help you understand like not only what attachment is, but what it actually causes and what are some of the signs that you may see or the manifestations that you may see in different people. So one of the first things I want to ask you, Shirley, can you kind of talk to me about like whenever you think of attachment, what comes to your mind?
Having a secure base, having the ability to have reciprocal, authentic relationships.
Perfect. Perfect. And I think that a lot of us, like whenever we kind of think about that, there might even like, you might be sitting here listening to this and maybe there's something that you can think about in your life, someone that was there for you and somebody that's really important to you, and they might be that secure person, that person you can go to. And some of you may be listening to this and it may not feel like there's anyone that was there for you. And those are a lot of the implications that we're talking about when we talk about attachment, right? So tell me, I guess one of the things that I think is maybe even most important for us to talk about is whenever someone doesn't have such good attachment, whenever they don't really have good attachment figures in their life or anything like that. And this is the type of work that you do all the time, Shirley. So tell me, if I'm someone that's listening to this, I'm like, okay, like, you know, and I'm thinking about attachment and why do I do the things that I do? What may be some signs that maybe I don't have such good attachments in my life, or I don't really have many people I can count on?
Well, I can tell you the symptomatology of the kids that I see. Would that be helpful?
That's perfect.
Yeah. Okay. I specialize in the treatment of kids with attachment disturbances coming from early neglect and trauma, neglect, abuse, and trauma. And what they learned early on is that I can't trust adults to take care of me. I have to take care of myself, which leads to this feeling of I have to be in control. You know, I can't depend on anyone for my needs. I have to take care of my own needs. It's too frightening to be dependent on. So they never develop really healthy dependence, which you have to do to develop healthy independence.
Right. So, like I can't count on my parents to get me food whenever I want food.
Exactly. Or, you know, when I'm hungry, I'm not fed. When I'm scared, I'm not held. When I'm bored, I'm not played with. When I'm poopy, I'm not changed. You know, all these things lead to the idea of adults are incompetent. You know, caretakers are incompetent to meet my needs. I have to meet my own needs. And I have to be in charge. I have to be in control. So most of the time, these kids are, you know, have this, you know, diagnosis as oppositional defiant disorder, which is, I hate that diagnosis because it's just a normal reaction to that kind of trauma. You know, anybody would have oppositional defiant disorder if they learned very early in their early schema that adults are not to be trusted. I got to take care of myself. I have to be in charge.
Yeah, I want to be careful because we could talk about how both of us agree on oppositional defiant disorder being a horrible diagnosis. But I think that
it's such a good, to me, it's like, you know,
well, if one of the signs that you're getting early on is that I can't rely on anybody else, it makes sense that whenever someone is trying to impose certain things on you, like, hey, you have to do X, Y, Z, it feels like they're limiting your ability to survive.
Absolutely.
I think that a lot of times that we may not always think that, right? And for some reason, like the first thing that kind of comes into my mind is if there's a kid that has been neglected, and usually a lot of kids that they may be neglected physically, but I think a lot of them are neglected emotionally is probably a little bit more common. And so if I'm kind of left to take care of my own emotional needs, and I'm a kid that has found out that playing video games really helps me get through stressful and hard times because it kind of takes my mind off things. And then I have my parent come and tell me like, hey, you can't take, or you can't continue playing video games like this, or you're playing too much. I'm going to flip out because that's what I have learned to do to try to soothe and take care of myself emotionally.
That's that pseudo independence that develops. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't get comfort from my parent. So I will, you know, and all addictions, including the video games, come from trauma and relationship trauma. And the video games are an attempt to substitute the warmth and the nurturing of from a parent. You know, it's a way of self-comforting.
Right. I'm always reminded of, I had a trainer before to tell me that, hey, if a person does not connect with another person, they will connect with something.
Yes.
And it can be anything.
It's clinging behavior. You know, if they don't have the ability to cling to that parent in any way, I see a lot of adopted kids who have been in orphanages and kids who have been, have had that kind of early relationship trauma where that bond between parent and child was broken. So that creates a whole lot of set of, you know, other issues.
Well, not only is that broken, but if you're in adoption care or orphanages or anything like that, then every relationship that you have is potentially temporary. So then those can't actually be safe either.
So the biggest fear that the kids I see have is abandonment. Mm-hmm. Abandonment and rejection. There's a lot of reasons for that. Because first of all, when bad things happen to children, to little children especially, they are in that stage of development of narcissism. So if a bad thing happens to them, they immediately have this cloak of shame that develops. I'm bad. I'm disgusting. I'm worthless. I'm ugly. I'm stupid. I'm a piece of garbage. You know, sometimes they actually name these things and sometimes they don't, but there is this feeling of there's something wrong with me. I'm not worthy. I'm not lovable. You know, and if you love me, what's wrong with you? Do you have bad taste in children? Are you lying to me? What's wrong with you?
Or you must be trying to get something from
me. Yeah, are you trying to get something from me? There's a lot of suspicion of any kind of closeness and intimacy. And what often happens when there's the extreme fear of intimacy, there's going to be a lot of push away behavior. I'm going to push you away before you can push me away. There's also this kind of counterphobia. What you fear most is abandonment. Sometimes what we do is we run towards that abandonment. We do everything we can to create that abandonment.
Right. Well, because relationships aren't safe. Right. Mm-hmm. So if we kind of even take this, right, and we take this type of behavior that we actually see in kids that may not really have a healthy attachment figure growing up. And so they kind of learn that I got to take care of myself. Other people maybe can't really be trusted. Then, and you take that and put it in an adult, that would mean that, like you're saying, they're having trouble with intimate relationships. Whenever people start to get close in relationships, they push them away or it feels very unsafe, or they find reasons to exploit issues in the relationship as an excuse to end the relationship.
Absolutely.
And this becomes really hard because one of the things that we're programmed as human beings is to connect to people and to attach. And if the only sign that I've gotten my whole life is that I can't trust people, at the same time, I have a biological and a neurobiological urge to connect with people. So it's almost like there's this war that is consistently going on inside of me that's telling me that I need people, but I cannot trust people. I cannot actually be around people.
That's absolutely true. Another thing happens with relationships is when you don't have a secure relationship with your parent, you're very likely to put that mommy and daddy love onto your peers. And sometimes those relationships become extremely intense and dependent. which right. leads to a lot of abusive, you know, being trapped in abusive relationships.
Right, right. Because at that point, if you have an insecure attachment, which is usually what we call that, is mm-hmm. insecure attachment, where you are afraid of losing someone that you've connected with, and abusive behavior can become really common. But it's also hard for you to be able to tell, because at that point, if someone has an insecure connection, insecure attachment, they don't usually have a lot of experience to know what is a normal relationship and what isn't.
Absolutely.
So you know what? Sometimes even an abusive relationship can feel and seem like it's normal to them, even though someone from the outside would be like, why are you with them?
Well, also, if you think you're unlovable and disgusting and worthless, then you're not going to find very unlikely to find someone who cares about you, you know, in the way that your needs are met in that way. You know, if someone treats you badly, oh, that's the key that fits the lock of how I feel about myself.
Right, right. And I love what you said right there, is that that is the key that fits the lock, right? Because that's my own internal perspective of me, is that I may not be worthy of love and care. And whenever someone else shows me that, it's a reflection of what I already feel and what I've already experienced throughout my life. And it's easy to kind of go towards something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's easy for us on the outside. A lot of times we could read different news articles, and we could hear different interviews with people, and you're like, I cannot believe they were in that relationship. I can't believe they stayed in that home. I can't believe this X, Y, and Z happened. But it makes sense from an attachment perspective.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. We as human beings were built to attach, and that doesn't mean we're built to attach in a healthy way all the time. And I hate saying that, a healthy way.
Yeah. And often, you know, the kids that I see, like especially the teenagers, if they have a boyfriend or girlfriend and they break up with them, the person leaves them. Of course, it becomes a trigger for abandonment. And it's almost like in their brain, in their unconscious, it's like a trigger from abandonment from first mother sometimes, you know, it becomes a big deal. So I have a lot of kids who start cutting, or they start, they make suicidal, you know, promises, you know, but they try to attempt suicide if someone leaves them,
right.
You know, it's like so many of the songs, you know, love songs we've heard over the years, sound like people with attachment issues, you know, I can't live if living is without you. You know, these people really do put their entire world onto, they put all their eggs in one basket. If right. they don't have a secure base in their family, they're going to take that whole carton of eggs and put it in that other person instead of taking one egg at a time, you know, and you know, just having right. a slow, steady relationship, it becomes, oh, you're my new person. You're right. my new family. Forget
so your family. You talk about this from like the kid's point of view. So I work mostly with couples, and I get to see this manifested in couples where there's a person that is insecure and they place their whole world on somebody else. And mm-hmm. the other person in the relationship feels this weight of, yes. I have to be able to be there for this person. And you know what? Life has to be good. And I have to put my needs aside a lot of times for them. I take it, it can go either way. Right.
Yeah.
Most of the time, whenever people make it to my office, that's what happens, is like, I've had to put my needs aside, and the partner learns to shut down and to kind of shut off emotionally so they can try to be there emotionally for the other person. Which, if you're someone that is really insecure and you've ever been around someone that's shut down, someone that's not talking a lot, that's not sharing a lot about things that are going on, it is the worst thing in the world. Because you being someone that is insecure is always trying to figure out, well, wait a second, are they going to leave me? Are things okay? Do they hate me? You know, those are the mild things that go on inside of their head. And so I see this all the time in my couples and marriage counseling as well, as far as people don't always recognize what this is, right? That we label it in our society, right? Oh, they're really needy. Now they're afraid of losing the only connection that they may have ever actually had.
Well, there's also the, you know, there's the complications of lack of object permanency, which is a technical term, but it's when there's not a secure attachment, attuned relationship in the first like 8 months of life. Normally it develops in the first 8 months of life when there's an attuned and attached relationship between main caregiver and child, and the child starts to believe the parent exists, whether they see them, touch them, smell them. And because of that symbiotic relationship, they start believing that they exist. So many of these people have a difficult time believing they exist. So they need an incredible amount of feedback and attention to even feel like they are real. And if you remember from school, if you don't have good object permanency, you can't have object constancy, which is the idea that in a relationship, if someone's mad at me or someone's upset with something I'm doing, that doesn't mean that they hate me.
Right.
You know, they can maintain the idea that someone, you know, I'm loved even though this person is upset with something I've done. Someone without that object constancy cannot do that. So it becomes a tragedy, you know. So any kind of fight becomes, you're going to leave me. You know, you
right.
hate me.
Because they may not necessarily have that understanding that, hey, you can be upset at me, but also not want to leave me at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably a lot easier for me to work on with couples because I have both of them in the room and the other person can be like, well, yeah, no, I'm not going to leave you. Like I can be mad that X, Y, Z happened.
Right.
So it's a lot easier for me to address different things like that in couples and marriage counseling. I wonder, what is it like for you whenever you're working with a kid in session? You're starting to see some of these things like, man, they don't have secure attachments. They got a lot of different challenges. Like, what's kind of the first things that you might do to help them start to create some of those secure attachments or have a little more better understanding around that part of themselves?
The primary and the hardest work I do is with between me and the parents. And teach them what's going on with the kid, why their behavior makes sense, how to get behind behavior instead of focusing on the behavior, which just increases shame, and how to create more empathic relationships, get behind relationships, normalize behavior, that sort of thing. Also, I want to point out that sometimes kids can have attachment disturbances not from any fault of the parents or any kind of an orphanage or foster care situation. Sometimes medical trauma or separation, you know, like parents who've had to leave to go to, you know, the military, you know, right after the child was born, you know, those kind of things. Separation from parents and also early medical trauma. I have a lot of kids who've had early medical trauma who have a lot of the same issues through no fault of anything that the parents have, any actions the parents have taken or their lack of attachment issues themselves.
Right. I think that's really important that you mention that, right? I think that, or sometimes just doing normal or things that would be normal in our society, right? Like, I think of whenever my son was born and whenever I went back to work, how much it was a big impact on him whenever I left every single day.
Absolutely.
Throwing this fit like he wasn't ever going to see me again because to him, he wasn't.
Yes.
Right? He wasn't.
He had that permanency, you know.
Right. And I think that's such a huge thing because we also live in a society of constant contact. Right? Hey, you should be able to text back and everything like that. And you kind of know whenever someone might have some type of attachment issue with that, whenever they're like, well, I sent you that text 2 minutes ago. How come you didn't respond? Right? You weren't there. You were no longer there. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important because this can happen in just normal circumstances, right? Going to work consistently. I know that, I know my wife and I have talked about this, that whenever she was young, her dad worked out of town all the time. And so she didn't, and over time, right, there was a more of an opportunity for him to be at home more. But whenever she's young and she talks about that, she's like, you know, dad wasn't always there. And, you know, the part that dad isn't here right now is impactful. And like I said, it's just normal things, right? And parents doing what they have to do in our society.
It's not really normal because in the sense of, I think this is the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't provide paid parental leave.
I mean, normal in our culture.
In our culture, yes.
Right. And I think it's hard because we start to be like, well, gosh, like everybody else is doing this around me. Shouldn't this be an easy peasy? Well, we got to think whenever humans are developing, even like if we were just look back, you know, even as short as like 50 to 100 years ago, much more likely to have at least one parent staying home, much more likely, or gosh, even if you look like 200 to 300 years ago, much more likely to have consistent exposure to both parental figures. Whereas now that's not the case. And because of that, we have a society of people that are very much have more insecure attachments with their parents. And like I said, not necessarily through any fault of the parents' own, like you said, but it is part of our development. It is part of something that we have to recognize and notice. That,
and it is a societal issue. I mean, even, you know, because most of these countries do have at least a year or so of paid parental leave where they can stay with their children because they do recognize the importance of those early relationship attachments. And it doesn't surprise me that I think in, you know, in our culture, because of that, we do have more of these issues with children. And who become adults who are still insecurely attached or non-attached.
Right. These, like some of the behavioral issues. I mean, I think about parents always talk about like, gosh, my kid's always on the phone, right? That they're always on the phone. Well, they became attached to the phone. Guess what? It's become a secure attachment for them.
They're looking for connection. Right. They're looking for connections, which they're not getting, that the parents can't give to them because of their working, you know, so much and or else their own attachment issues themselves.
So help me whenever, so let's say that someone's listening to this right now and they're like, well, this is me all over. I know I got some insecure attachments, or, hey, this is my husband. This is my wife. This is, you know, my daughter, my son, my kid, whatever. What's the kind of first thing that they should do? Like if they're like, yeah, I understand this and I think that's real. What's kind of the first thing that they should do to trying to create a more secure attachment with them?
Therapy might help. Yeah. Obviously. But what I've created just with my parents, you know, I have this silly acronym that I use and they have found it very helpful. It's called SNEE, like sneeze without the rest of the letters. And basically it's making, with their children anyway, they're making sense of the behavior instead of criticizing the behavior, making sense of the behavior, getting behind the behavior and figuring out why this behavior was functional for them, at least at one time or another, why it became so functional. And then the N in the SNE is normalizing it. If I had been, and normalizing always loosens shame. It really helps lower shame when you can normalize the situation. You know, that makes sense. You know, if I had been through what you had been through, I would react in the same way. That's a normal human reaction. Right. And then most of all, empathy. When I think of the fear and the sadness and the grief and the confusion that you went through during that time, it just breaks my heart. Right. And I always tell parents, if they can even feel emotion and show sadness and even cry about what happened to the child, it helps the child connect with their feelings, because kids with this kind of early trauma and attachment issues have learned to numb out their feelings.
Right. Well, even if they haven't had this, they haven't had this happen, that part of the brain isn't fully developed yet. So they wouldn't necessarily be able to connect those two things, as well as the parent acting as the prefrontal cortex and helping them link those things together.
Right. Well, the kids I have are very pretty deficient in their executive function, mm-hmm. you know, because early trauma has especially effects on the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, you know, the things, it's those parts of the brain that help calm down the amygdala, the fear receptor of the brain. So there's a lot of lack of emotional regulation, which right. often leads to other diagnoses like bipolar disorder.
Well, I want to jump in really quick. So like when we talk about hippocampus, that is often referred to as the short-term and or working memory. Mm-hmm. So the hippocampus, so if like you have a kid that like forgets things a lot, there's chances are that their hippocampus might be impaired. Yeah. Or sometimes even if like there are some cases where children can actually be extremely or exceptionally clumsy mm-hmm. and their hippocampus can be impaired because whenever we have certain skills, I always like to use riding a bike as an example. As soon as you get on the bike, your memory is going to go and grab the memories of how to ride a bike and bring it forward to your hippocampus so that you can actually operate that.
You don't have enough hippocampal material or you know, frontal lobe material, you're going to have a lot of brainstem dominance, you know, right. which is the fight, flight, freeze part of the brain. And when you're in the fight, flight, freeze part of the brain, you're going to be in a constant state of hypervigilance and fear and terror, which doesn't lead to a lot of learning. You know, right. these kids often think they're stupid. You know, these are extremely bright children. And when I start seeing them, they're making, you know, they're failing school. And it's interesting how so many of them, once they establish a more secure relationship with their parents, start getting A's and B's all of a sudden. Kids who have been diagnosed as learning disabled, you know, and all kinds of diagnoses are.
Right. Well, it's because they're dedicating all the brain power is going towards survival.
Exactly. They're in the survival yeah. part of the brain. And that's another reason why, you know, I teach parents not to do a lot of lecturing. If you're lecturing to a child who's in the brainstem, it's like me trying to give you a cookie recipe when your house is burning down.
Right.
You're not going to get much of it.
So you know? I actually want to do something here really quick. Mm-hmm. Whenever you're kind of talking about this, like even the idea of whenever I see a behavior, first helping like validate the behavior, the feeling and that goes along with it, to making sure that you understand why, like you can show them that like, hey, I'm on the same page with you. I get why you're doing that. And showing that level of empathy is the way to help start establishing a more secure relationship. Because at the end of the day, if you understand what's going on, then the person's ultimately going to trust you more. Right. Whether or not. So I want to go through different examples that we can do for different age groups.
Okay. Right.
So I'll first start with, at the time of this recording, you and I were talking about this before we started recording. My son's knocking on the door 2 years old at the time of this recording. So whenever he is trying to put like a block that's, you know, the perfect shape and inside, you know, this container, right, it's a pretty common toy, and he can't get it, he flips out, right? Mm-hmm. Because that is one of the worst things that's happened in his life, in his two-year-old life, is that I can't get this block that's a square shape inside the circle peg hole.
Very frustrating.
Oh, yeah. And it is super frustrating. He gets mad and he'll throw it. And yeah, I'll sit down on the ground with him and be like, man, I could see it. This is frustrating. I tell you what, I do stuff like that all the time. I get frustrated too whenever I'm trying really hard to get something in there. And there's sometimes too where I'll like, you know, I, as therapists, you know, like you match their tone, right? Like,
yeah.
Gosh, that is super frustrating. I cannot believe that cannot go in there. I mean, yeah. Gosh, that is just the worst thing.
You want to match the affect, you know, which uh-huh. as Daniel Hughes calls it loud empathy.
Right. And yeah. Even my son at 2 years old, as soon as I do that, he calms down.
Of course.
Yeah, he calms down and he's fine after that, right? So like that's maybe at like the younger age, like let's say like 5 or 6, right? What's something that a kid may do that that we may see at that age.
Well, you know, the other thing that's going on too is kids with this kind of early trauma and attachment disturbances have three different ages. They have their chronological age. They might be 6 years old chronologically. They might be 10 years old cognitively. Many of these survivor kids are very smart, but emotionally they might be stuck between 0 and 4.
Right.
So let's say, like, some of the same things with these kids at that age that you would do with your 2 year old, you know?
Right. So, like, yeah, maybe a 6 year old gets really upset because they wanted pasta tonight and we didn't get pasta. You know, we had, or mom and dad wants me to eat like a vegetable. And so they get really upset and they flip their, they flip their plate. And it's okay to go upside them and be like, I really get this frustrating and I understand this, right? You want to be able to eat whatever it is that you want to eat. And I'm telling you that you have to eat this stuff and it's not great. And that makes sense that it's frustrating. Yeah. I totally understand that. And sometimes I get frustrated too whenever I have to eat, my fruits and vegetables. And there's times that whatever mom or dad make, I don't want to eat it either. So, I get that. You let them know that it's okay. And I think that parents are, and then, you get teenage years. I always hear about kids ask like, hey, can I use the car to go hang out with my friends? Parents are like, no. And what happens? Teenager gets really mad. They may yell or they may sulk or anything like that. Yeah. And it's okay. But, hey, I understand that sucks. Like, you were really looking forward to hanging out with your friends and it feels like I just kind of wrecked your night. Right.
Well, also with kids who've had this kind of early trauma, when you say no, it means two things. It means you don't love me and I'll never get what I need. And they go into, a dysregulated state. You know, so there's ways to approach it, to say no, without getting them so triggered. Or sometimes if they do get triggered, you can actually say, hold on, when I said no just now, do you think that means I don't love you? I don't care about your needs, or you'll never get what you need. And if so, I can understand why you'd be upset. I'd be upset too.
Right. A lot of times what I tell parents is like, I actually care about you being able to hang out with your friends. Mm-hmm. And I want you to be able to hang out with your friends. And, right now we just can't do that because X, Y, Z, but like, I want you to be able to, and I get why you're frustrated. Stuff like that. I don't blame you for that. And it becomes a different type of conversation.
Absolutely. And talking about the disappointment, that's got to be really disappointing. And part of me would really like to say yes to this because why? You're so important to me.
And I think that parents, sometimes they feel like I have to take a hard line with things. And part of that's just American culture, right? Like,
this
pull yourself.
Yeah. Punishment stuff that doesn't work, with children.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't work with adults either. Research is pretty clear with that.
Exactly. Just on the news, they talked about putting 12-year-olds in prison, with adults. Like, the more punishment, if we just make things more miserable for these traumatized people, then they will change.
Right.
Doesn't work. The whole world of reward and punishment has to be rethought, because that's something I do teach my parents, is to stop with this reward and punishment whole thing.
Well, in all reality, the more and more that you can join with your kid, whenever they have a what you might classify as like a negative behavior or anything, the more and more you can join with them and show a little bit of that empathy with them, the more and more like it feels like that they can count on you. And that's more what you want, right? That's more of what you want to continue to communicate. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to give in to your child.
No.
Right? And I like to tell parents that, because like, your kid's a kid, and especially if they've had some type of attachment trauma, they're not thinking on all cylinders. And even if they don't have any of this, they're still not thinking of all cylinders because their brain's not fully developed.
They need extremely clear limits.
Right.
Without negotiation, without that, because so many parents get into this negotiation, you can watch TV until 7:30. And then at 7:30, the kid says, how about another 15 minutes or half an hour? And then there'll be all this negotiation. Yeah. But what that does is it makes the child trust the parent less. Oh, the parent really doesn't mean what they say.
Right.
You know, so there's a way of setting limits without being harsh or cruel or mean. You know, and you know, before the time limit is up, in 15 minutes we're going to have to turn off the TV, and I know that's frustrating to you, and that's hard when you have to go from one thing you like a lot to something you don't like a lot, and I'm going to be here for you, and it's going to be okay, you know, that kind of stuff, without...
It's going to be okay,
without having to change the rules, without have to, you know, while maintaining some very strict limits, without harshness, without rudeness, without meanness, you know, this can be done. So it doesn't mean that you're a laissez-faire parent, that you can just let them do whatever they want. They do need that kind of structure, but also they need it combined with a lot of nurture and connection.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's one of the things that's like really important, like what you said, just kind of reiterating this. A lot of times parents do this without intending, one, and two, there are things that you can do right now today that can help with it. And a lot of it is just empathizing and trying to communicate that you understand. And you don't communicate that you understand by always saying, I understand, right? Mm-hmm. Actually explain out how you understand and how you get what it is that you said or what you did. Mm-hmm. And I love how you said the no thing. My wife and I were literally just talking about this today on our walk. That so many times kids hear no, and the more and more they hear no, the more and more they learn that they have to push and try to negotiate.
Right.
But kids are more likely to hear yes, or like, well, how about a choice between this or that? Yeah. Then whenever you say no, it's more likely to be a hard boundary for them already without you actually having to fight for it.
Right.
And I think that's super important, or sometimes like the illusion of choice, right?
And well, there's something called, remember we talked about, you learned about intermittent reinforcement. Mm-hmm. There is intermittent reinforcement, because what many parents will do is they will say no 20 times, and then on the 21st time they'll say okay already, they'll give right. in, which makes the kid, you're creating.
I got to push 21 monster. Times to get what I want.
Yeah, I got to push. You know, it's like gambling. That's why gambling is so addictive, because it's intermittent reinforcement. You don't win every time. Yeah.
And when we say intermittent reinforcement, so intermittent is pretty constant. The hardest thing is random reinforcement. And when what we mean is like on every like 21st time, like Shirley said, they'll get the affirmative, or they'll get the response that they want. Right. So if every time I call my dog, if I say, come here, and on the fifth time, my dog's like, okay, I'm going to come over there, then the dog is actually reinforcing with me that I have to say, come here at least five times before it comes over. Right. Mm-hmm. Now if my dog randomly in between one and five times will come here, then I get reinforced that I'm going to have to just keep on telling them to come here until they end up coming here. So and since people are a lot smarter than animals usually, then, you know, of course things can get a lot more complex with that. So for us, it's easy to see that people that have attachment needs, which are all of us, can fall into these different types of traps. Mm-hmm. And so for us as parents, one of the most important things, and even us in our relationships, one of the most important things is to continue to help people and to communicate with them that even whenever they get the negative, that things are still okay between us, right? Mm-hmm. There's times, so my wife and I, every night before we go to bed, we pray. And there's sometimes whenever we pray at night where I'm like, hey, I'm going to pray on my own tonight. And every time that I say that, she's like, are you mad at me? Mm-hmm. And so now I have to be like, hey, I'm going to pray on my own tonight. I'm not mad at you or anything. There's just something specific I want to pray about. And sometimes I'll be like, I'm just going to pray about this, or I'm going to pray about that. Or I'm going to go to bed early and I don't want to wait for you, so I'm going to pray on my own. And I always had to remind her that like, hey, like it isn't because I'm mad or anything like that. It isn't because, you know, it's like that. And if there's anything that you get from this, it's important that whenever your child or person that's important in your life hears a negative from you, that they still can also get that message from you that you still care about them, right? And that you still love them. You know, if my son does something I really don't like, and a lot of you parents will understand or agree with this, and you'll think that your kid should know that, but they don't, mm-hmm. right? To be like, you know, if my kid is in there and he's throwing Legos everywhere and I yell at him because he's making a mess, he also needs to know that just because I yell at him doesn't mean I love him any less. Mm-hmm. You know, just the same thing that my wife might need that whenever, you know, she made dinner the other night and I ate it and I was like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. Like, we should not have tried this new recipe. She still really needs to know that I appreciated her making dinner and I appreciated her doing that for me. Because if she doesn't, then, right, we start to build up those adverse messages. It's not like someone that they're in a secure relationship and things are golden for the rest of their life. We can have secure relationships and still pop back out of them and still develop insecure attachment styles or anything, or have attachment trauma with mm-hmm. those types of things.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I think that one of the most key things, if you're listening to this, is okay, letting people know that it's okay and really trying to validate and really trying to empathize with where they are is something that's super helpful for them. And I'm almost kind of wondering here while I'm kind of in this space and I'm thinking about it. It sounds like one of the other things that would be really helpful, like besides just letting them know that you love them, that you care about them, and that you're there with them, is being able to circle back around later on to talk about something afterwards. Because a lot of times people are like, well, you say that now, but in 10 minutes later, and an hour later, and a day later, and a week later, are you still going to feel this way? Mm-hmm. Are you still going to care about me? Right? These are consistent messages that we have to give people mm-hmm. to help them feel good in our relationships. Right? My son also, go ahead.
Okay. What I, you know, with traumatized kids, one of the first things I teach parents also is not to show anger, irritation, annoyance. You know, because if a child is in the brain stem, which is the fear, you know, part of the brain, the fight, flight, freeze part of the brain, it's like putting gasoline on a fire. And especially when these kids come with all of this shame, I'm not good enough, I'm unworthy, I'm unlovable, any kind of criticism or correction is not going to be trusted. You know, you cannot criticize or correct a child who doesn't trust you. So the trust has to be maintained first before any of that can happen.
Right. Well, and so, all right, a parent may be listening to this and they may be like, how am I supposed to not get angry about things? Like, I'm a human being. So yeah. The answer is, like, you will get angry at things. And that means you have to circle back and you have to go and talk to the kid, or you have to go and talk to, you know, your partner about it. It's like, hey, I got angry there, and like, it's just, everything was just really overwhelming with me. And mm-hmm. well, like, you know, like, you had to put the owner.
What? Some people have suggested 30 seconds of screaming and then just saying, and I'm not mad at you anymore. You know, because kids will continue to think, oh, you hate me. You know, right. Kids will continue to think you hate me. But there is a way of visualizing, or, you know, conceptualizing that the kid isn't doing this to me, because so many times parents get angry because they take very much personally anything that these kids do, the behavior they do. And when parents can disconnect from that and see that the behavior makes sense, there's a lot less anger from the parent. Right. That's for sure.
I was actually talking with a mom about this today on the phone. Like, just because your kid did this doesn't mean that your kid doesn't love you, doesn't care right. about you. Right. And the same thing is that when we as parents may get angry, like, it's okay to go to our kid and be like, hey, you know, I got really angry. I was really overwhelmed. And it's okay to talk with them about the components that went into it too. You are showing them one, what it's like to appropriately do after you get angry. Like, it's okay to be able to talk about it, and it's okay to be able to there, because there is times where it's okay to show anger, right? Mm-hmm. Anger is going to come up in your life. You're not going to go throughout your life without getting angry or frustrated or upset or anything like that. And being able to show them that, hey, like, I was angry earlier whenever I said X, Y, Z. And, you know, I wanted to let you know that there's a lot going on for me, and that wasn't okay that I did that. And I didn't, you know, I didn't want you to do that. I want to let you know that I still love you and care about you. And you can circle back and talk about that again later.
Apologizing is modeling vulnerability, mm-hmm. which kids with high defenses can't have. You know, it's very difficult for them to have vulnerability. And there's this pressure on them that they feel like they have to be perfect to be okay. Mm-hmm. And when the parent shows, I'm not perfect, you know, it is helpful for the kid to know that, you know, that he doesn't have to be perfect in order to be loved.
Exactly. Right. And that anger is not a permanent emotional state of a parent. Right. I like to think that. So if I come home after a day of work, I've had a ton of experience that have contributed to my mood and my feeling mm-hmm. and where I'm at in that given point in time. So sometimes, like, whenever I may not have my best foot forward when I come home, like, sometimes it's okay just like showing the kid or showing the spouse, like, just unpacking that, like, sorry, I've had a lot of things that have gone on. And like, it's not necessarily like that isn't all that I'm just upset or angry at you. Like, I've just had a lot of stuff going on, and, you know, I just haven't had that time to decompress, and it's all just built up inside of me. And, you know, I didn't really mean for it to come out like that. And I didn't want for it to come out like that. And I'm sorry. It gives that good sense of modeling and a good sense of appropriate use and appropriate dismantling of anger in a situation. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of wondering, I know that we've went over a lot of different aspects of attachment. I'm kind of wondering, while we're kind of even just sitting in this moment, is there anything, Shirley, that you feel like we kind of really missed, or we really kind of skipped over at this point?
Not that I can think of.
All right.
You know, so, it might come to me later, you know.
So I think if there's anything that you're hearing from this, is that it's very common for people to have attachment styles and attachment and meaningful relationships and have challenges with them.
And also, it's on a continuum that, right. You know, secure attachment or attachment itself is on a continuum mm-hmm. to very insecurely attached to, you know, very, very secure attached. And then there's even earned attachment, which is a secure attachment that develops when someone has not had it as a child and develops it, you know, through therapy or through their own, you know, as an adult, you know, that happens too.
And at the end of the day, attachment just does not stop with your family and friends. Mm-hmm. It goes to work relationships. It goes to acquaintances. It goes to how you really behave around everybody.
Yeah.
Right. I'm reminded of, different times where you talk to people and they might say, like, well, I don't trust anybody until they give me a reason to. Well, that's insecure attachment, right? and most all of us have, like you said, we're on that continuum, and we may have different levels of that. And yeah. That's okay. That means that the work that we do around this and the kind of steps that we take to develop those more secure attachments, it means all of us are working towards that. All of us are working more towards validating and understanding and empathizing with people. And yeah. That does tremendous benefit to kids. Yeah. And guess what? When you empathize with your kid, they stop doing that behavior that you may not enjoy so much.
Yes, absolutely. I also want to talk about the relationship between shame and guilt, because right. People use those terms interchangeably, and they're very, very different. And with the kids that I see, many of them have gone through such trauma and such abuse and such neglect that they have extreme amount of shame. And when they have that kind of extreme amount of shame, what oftentimes happens is that these kids don't have any empathy for themselves. You know, I'm bad, I'm disgusting, I'm just bad, I'm worthless, I'm unlovable. And the higher the shame, the worse the behavior, and the less empathy for the self. When they have no empathy for the self, they can't have empathy for other people.
Right.
It's very difficult for them to have empathy for other people, and that other people includes their future self. So that's why consequences, you know, the regular consequences and punishments for these children do not work, because, you know, 15 minutes from now, I don't care about 15 minutes older me. You know, I want what I want it now. And what happens to me in the future does not matter, which has big implications for school, you know, and doing schoolwork. Why should you do schoolwork? Schoolwork is all towards the future. And they don't conceptualize or have trust in the future. And many of these kids, if they do not have the proper treatment and they don't develop these trusting, reciprocal, loving relationships, will end up with a lot of sociopathic behavior. They right. don't care about what they, you know, hurt people hurt people. So right. a lot of times these people end up being very immoral, you know, or amoral. They develop.
Well, and a lot of empathy is a thing that helps with shame. And that makes sense, because it feels like what they're going through isn't okay. Yeah. A lot of people that are suicidal have a lot of shame.
Absolutely. They don't believe they deserve to live. I don't deserve to live, which is a very high shame component. You know, right. I'm so disgusting that I don't deserve to live. People will be better off without me.
Right. So talk to me a little bit about guilt then.
Okay. Well, guilt is the higher the shame, the lower the guilt.
Right.
And when we can lower the shame, the conscience can develop. We can develop good consciousness. And as we talked about, with when I train my parents to be much more empathetic to their children about their pain, the child automatically internalizes it. And they become much more, they develop much more empathy. They start saying, I'm sorry, and they mean it, you know, because what I often tell parents is, don't make the child say he's sorry, because you're teaching him to lie. If they really don't have any conscience development, they don't feel sorry when they hurt, when they killed the dog, or, you know, or hurt another child, or you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
They don't feel bad about it, you know, because they're just numb to it. The other thing that happens, you know, is addictions. I think addictions are very connected to this kind of trauma and shame. That addiction, that trauma creates a lot of times a lot of fear of emotions and emotional phobia. So they develop addictions in order to numb out. You know, and if they are not in a place where they can be safe with their emotions, they're going to be highly susceptible to addictions in later life. And the addictions right. can be video games. It could be, porn is a big addiction.
It could be anything that they could connect to.
It can be anything. It could be smoking.
So whenever someone is actually developing guilt, that's actually a good sign.
That's a good sign.
In some way that consciousness is developing in a direction that we want.
Yeah.
Now I will say one thing about that is, right. Right. We don't want person to sit in guilt for a long time. It's a nasty spiral that people can get
into.
But
I think sometimes people get the word shame and guilt confused.
Right. Or like you said, they use them interchangeably and they're not.
Guilt is the idea that I want to repair. You know, I feel bad. I want to repair this relationship. I want to repair and compensate for what I've done. Shame is just the idea of I'm disgusting and worthless and bad.
Right. Guilt can do two things. It can propel you towards action, or it can propel you away from people because it feels like you're hurting them too much. And if you're in a more secure relationship and people see that you're feeling guilty, they'll notice you pulling away and they will give you things that you can do that are actionable.
Yeah.
And I think that's super important, because like guilt can be a very powerful relationship protecting feeling
yeah.
to help reconcile things. And it can also be a very damaging thing if it's allowed to play out like this is, you know, I am hurting them by being around them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's an important distinction mm-hmm. that you said. I'm really glad you brought it up. I'm really glad that you explained it in the way that you did. Right. Attachment's complicated.
Yeah.
Right. It's actually, I think it's like one of those things. It's simple. It's simple because all of us have it, but it's hard to work with and it's hard to do, especially in our culture, because we do so many things opposite of what we actually need to do.
Right.
And, you know, I think one of the biggest things is the lack of understanding in generations, the lack of understanding with, you know, I'm going through my own stuff doesn't mean that you can't empathize and validate somebody else. And I may have used this example on the podcast before, but I know I use this example sometimes with my couples, and I like to go to extremes, right? So I like to say that just because I can understand terrorism and I can understand why someone would do terrorist-like activities, and I could actually empathize with them. I can understand through things that have gone through in their life that has made them get to the point where they're willing to do some of the things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that I have to agree with it.
Right. Right.
It doesn't mean that I have to be okay with it. And it's the same thing in our relationships. And especially in our relationships, like we can communicate frustration or upset feelings in a relationship and still reinforce that we love and care about people and that things are okay. We get to hold both of those things at the same time. And a lot of times in our world, we treat them like absolutes, mm-hmm. right? Or we assume that the other person knows, right? I love it whenever my couples go, well, like, you know, my spouse knows that I love them. It's like, do they? Do they really?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they really knew that you love them, then it would be easy for you just to turn and tell them right now. And you just do it. You just automatically do it. And you'd be able to show that part. But it's not, right? Because we're kind of taught that their absolutes exist, and it doesn't have to exist with people. It doesn't have to exist whenever.
Well, so much of our culture, you know, in movies and books is good and evil.
Right.
You know,
dichotomies.
There's been changes, like in like some of the pictures, like Toy Stories. Did you see Toy Story, the movie, the Pixar movie?
I have. I've not seen the most recent ones because I heard they're really sad, so I avoid them.
Oh, but what I thought was so great about it, you know, it's a movie for children. Is it, you know, the bad guy, you know, I can't remember the name, the bear. You know, it there was an explanation of what happened to this bear to make him so cruel. You know, the trauma that had happened to the bear. It's like, whoa, this is interesting.
Right.
You know, an interesting explanation of what creates behavior. Because all in my world, all behavior makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So this may be a little bit off subject, but so I'm a big and avid reader and storyteller. Like I listen to an insane amount of audiobooks and stuff all the time. I'm a big story-driven person. Mm-hmm. And the best stories are where they have villains that by the end you're like, were they really a villain though?
Right.
Like they were just someone that was really hurt and they made yes. a lot of bad decisions with that. And yes. some of the best movies, some of the best books and TV shows and everything, they really have you understanding what's going on. And you have people in your life right now that you can understand more, and you can show them that you understand more by empathizing, and they will have more secure attachments with you. You want better friendships? Empathize with people more. Allow them to connect with you. You want a better relationship with your spouse? You do the same thing. You want a better relationship with your kids? Do the same thing, right? Rinse and repeat. It's something that's really important, and it's something that we haven't always been taught.
And children are much more likely to follow what you want them to do and internalize your values, you know, in that way.
Right.
you know, but not by criticism and correction and fear, but when they really like you and admire you and have respect for you, but, and you've respected them, they're much more likely to internalize you, and you don't have to worry what they're going to do behind your back.
Right. Right. Well, Shirley, I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm really glad that you made the time to come on here and talk with me about this. And I'm just kind of wondering, let's say that somebody's listening to this and they're like, wow, Shirley really knows what she's talking about, and I'd like to work with her. I'd like to ask her some questions or kind of find out more about what she's doing. Where can people find you, or how can they contact you?
They can call me. I have a phone. It's 314-374-4753. I also have a website. It needs to be updated, but it is www.attachmenttrauma.com. And I can be emailed also at S as in Sam, R as in rabbit, Crenshaw, CRENSHAW at charter.net.
Perfect. And again, thank you so much for coming on and being able to talk with me about this and share your experience. I think that our listeners will get a really joy out of actually having an episode that really just focuses on this part, and especially having someone that's so knowledgeable about it. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thank all of you for listening to this episode of Mental Health Insights. We hope that you found it helpful, and we look forward to the next episode that we get to bring out for you guys. Until then, please be well and stay safe. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. The music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.